All right, welcome everybody to the Flipside Show. Today we have a really fun one for you guys. We will be talking about the chemtrails theory in company of Max Bliss, who is known on YouTube for his support of the theory. And we will also have Bob, who is a trained chemist and who will attempt to explain some of the stuff scientifically. As usual, my co-host Kit, who does an amazing job, by the way, behind the scenes, will be on the show with us. Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
Good to be back.
Indeed.
I think we're going to have to wait a little bit for Max.
No problem. So, Bob, care to introduce us a bit to the world of chemistry while our guest comes back? Or introduce yourself?
Well, I'll do that then. Yeah, I'm Bob, a chemistry graduate. And, yeah, I don't really believe in chemtrails.
Right.
Have you even thought about chemtrails before we asked you to do this show?
I've seen the so-called conspiracy theories behind chemtrails and things before, but never really looked into it much.
Until now.
Yes, until now.
All right. So, how do you think the debate will go tonight? Are you pumped as I am?
I'm hoping it'll be a good debate and hopefully quite fun.
Indeed. I actually don't know that much about chemtrails, so I think it will be quite interesting.
Yeah, hopefully.
I think the debate is going to be a little, it's going to be interesting, but I think it'll be hard to keep it just on chemtrails, because from what I've read, it sort of ties into a lot of things like weather management and possibly poisoning the population, and there are lots of theories as to what chemtrails do. So I think it might be a little difficult to keep it on the chemtrails as such, but we'll give it a go. And Max, whenever you're back, feel welcome to chime in.
Welcome back.
We are live.
You're live now. We're live. Hello.
So Kara, do you have a moment to introduce yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name's Max Bliss, and I have become an activist and researcher into chemtrails and various other issues for about the last year, full time, really. And I made lots and lots of videos on YouTube of all the different chemtrails and phenomena I could see in the sky, which was completely unusual. And so I've documented what I've seen, and I went and took some rainwater analysis because some of the research was pointing towards there being heavy metals and various chemicals in the rainwater. And so I did those. I had those tests done in the laboratory for myself, and they came back excessively high above normal in the content. So that spurred me on to find out more, and eventually, after many, many hours and lots of research, I feel convinced that chemtrails is a real program that's going on. And it's prompted me to take time out of my life to do all I can to raise awareness.
Right. Well, sounds like you did your homework.
I think there's still a lot to learn. And, of course, without full disclosure, a lot of it is the best you can get from research that's available.
Right. All right. So if it's all right with you guys, we're going to start asking some questions. And as mentioned before, you will get to answer. And Bob will chip in if he feels like there's something he can contribute to.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, well, I was going to ask you, how did you get into chemtrails? But I think you already pretty much answered that. So
one thing I didn't mention was that I've worked outside my entire lifetime, and I worked outside weather dependent. So I was often very aware of what the normal sky would look like, because I literally would have to go home if it was raining. So, I was often aware of what the weather forecast was and what the weather was doing. And I could honestly say I was very familiar with what the sky looks like. So when I did start to see these trails in the sky, and it became apparent that it was different than what I'd noticed over 25 years.
Right. So, okay, could you give us a bit of background on what chemtrails are exactly? Because some of us are not familiar with it.
Well, basically, they're trails that are left behind airplanes.
Right.
And they're not constantly left behind airplanes. And a lot of people, when they come across chemtrails, when they do the first bit of research, they come across contrails. And a lot of people will stop at that point and be satisfied that all they see in the sky are contrails from airplanes. But right. It's quite easy if you look at old films and old photographs, lots of photographs, really. You won't see these very, very strong lines, these images that are very, very blatant in the sky like we see today. You know, in the recent past, we didn't see those sort of things. You only have to look at films like Top Gun. We've got aerial, you've got planes in the sky, and you don't see trails coming from them. Or just look at old photos, just old films like Quadrophenia or Mona Lisa. They're films that are made in Brighton. Whenever you see a sky, you never see lines in the sky.
So what makes you think that the chemtrails you speak about are different from contrails? Okay.
Well, what I've been filming now for about a year, and I've watched them being turned on, turned off, to make specific shapes in the sky. Tremendous size grids in the skies where planes are flying along, and it literally, a trail comes on at a specific point, like it touches one of the other trails, appears to touch it, and then it comes on, and it will carry on flying, and then there's a couple of trails in the distance, and when it reaches the other trail, it will turn off again. So I know that's not an engine, or that's not a little pocket of warm air or cold air, or, you know, it's the humidity isn't specifically different there, because I can also see, in a film I've made, a plane, a normal plane, flying across, not leaving a trail at all. So to confirm that the atmospheric conditions...
You haven't considered that could be related to the different altitudes, the humidity?
I establish the altitudes quite often because I use Flight Radar 24. I mean, obviously, I haven't got a really expensive pair of rangefinder 20,000 meter binoculars, so that would be an ideal way to have an absolutely definite altitude check, because I could bounce it from my location, couldn't I, and guess. But no, they're using Flight Radar 24. With a lot of planes, 75% of planes, I can verify the altitude. And not only that, when I'm videoing them, I mean, quite often, I now get to see the same type of planes most of the time. If I can zoom in on a plane at maximum zoom, and I've got a good idea of whether or not that's at the normal altitude. Does that make sense?
Sort of, but I think that could end up misleading you with, like, atmospheric conditions leading to apparent magnification.
If I see a plane flying and making an on-off thing, it's quite alarming. It catches your eye. And then I see another plane that, for all intents and purposes, is exactly the same size on my maximum zoom. And bear in mind, I've been doing this quite a lot. I mean, I think there's over 700 videos that I've uploaded. That's a fraction of what I've actually done. I'm quite familiar with. I can tell the difference when a plane is much lower.
I mean, at the altitudes these planes fly, the difference between a couple of thousand feet is not going to be very apparent,
isn't it?
Not overly.
Well, I would tend to ask if there is any accurate way to measure it.
Well, apart from using Flight Radar 24, which I use. The only way I can think of would be to get these. You can get an expensive, it's about £3,000. You can buy a set of laser rangefinder binoculars that will go up to 20,000 meters. So, I mean, if it's directly above, you might be fortunate because most planes fly at 11,000 meters, or between 8,000 and 11,000. So, you should have a good opportunity when it's directly above you to at least get an indication. Or if you have a set location, you could sort of say, I'm going to do it, I'm going to have them on a tripod and do it at that point. I don't know.
You should also be able to determine the altitude by monitoring the transponder frequencies.
Is that what I'm talking about, Flight Radar 24? That's what I use as transponder.
It's getting it off somewhere else, but yeah, you should be able to monitor those frequencies directly, though.
Well, I'd like to do that. I'd like anything I can get to actually confirm the altitudes is good. But, I mean, as far as seeing visible chemtrails, I mean, basically, if you're new to this, I've got thousands of hours logged watching these planes. And basically, there's all kinds of strange things, like projected lines in front of the plane, for example. People talk about the black lines. Well, I've filmed it where the sun is in the wrong position for it to be a shadow, and the plane is following the black line until eventually it's gone.
Right.
Which, of course, I've got quite a few examples of that, because it's not just the one time. I don't believe that there's a reasonable explanation to suggest what that could be.
I have someone here who's asking if the size of the plane would make a difference of the size of the contrails.
It shouldn't do.
Well, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because some contrails or some chemtrails have different lengths. And it does make you wonder what it is. If it's about heat and temperature and moisture content, humidity, why should one plane make a very short contrail and one make a very long contrail if the humidity is the same in the atmosphere and the heat is... the engine's running at full power. It's pretty much the same heat, isn't it? You know, it's why is there such a difference?
The visibility of them will also rely on angles between you and the sun for the reflections off the trails.
Yeah, I've videoed planes. I've got a brilliant example for you, right? I've got a brilliant example which happened. Unfortunately, I have got a copy of it, right? I've videoed just recently two Airbus 330s, and there was only 500 meters difference in altitude, and one had an horizon to horizon persistent contrail, and the other one just had a short dissipating one, and they were only 500 meters apart. They were both from Air France, and they were both Airbus A330s. But there is a difference in the picture of the engines. One's got a great big cone on the end of it.
Right.
So, I mean, these planes are very, very similar, only 500 meters apart in altitude, which I verified using Flight Radar 24. But one of them has got an horizon to horizon, well, from the plane, from the plane to the horizon, as far as you can see. Persistent contrail, and the other plane, which is right side by side, but it's only 500 meters difference in altitude, has it got a very short dissipating one.
I see. And do you know a bit about, I know you got into it last year, you said, but do you know a bit about how the theory itself started? Like, who were the first people to notice them?
No.
No? Oh, well, I was hoping to get a bit of history on that, but...
No, I mean, when you start looking into it, it depends on, I mean, chemtrails were mentioned by Congressman Dennis Kucinich in 2001 when he did his space preservation bill, because he wanted to supposedly to make sure that space couldn't be weaponized. And chemtrails was mentioned as an exotic weapon. And then when it was resubmitted, chemtrails was taken out of it.
Right.
Are you aware of that?
Yeah, I did
You're
read a bit
it, aren't
about...
You? And there are questions that have been in British, in the UK as well, about chemtrails submitted in the past. They have been mentioned. It's not like it's something that's just been made up and it's a slang word. And it's, I mean, the thing is, the difficulty is, there's a very, very simple thing. Before the 90s, there were still lots of jets flying around. I used to live near Gatwick Airport. It's one of the busiest airports near London. And I used to work all around there, and I used to see planes flying all the time. And they never had these great big long trails, and they never left X's in the sky or grids. So what is the difference between then and now? Because it never used to happen before.
Well, actually, I did post a link earlier.
Say again? That was confusing, man.
I did post a link earlier. I'm going to post it in the Skype as well, which has photos of contrails through history.
Oh, yeah, sure. No. Contrails have been around through history. And you know what?
Right,
even
right.
Persistent contrails have been around in history. But they have been experimenting using different things. They were using persistent contrails during the Second World War to make it more difficult to spot bombers. They've been spraying things into the atmosphere for a long, long time. So it's very easy to go and find evidence of contrails. In fact, if you look at the jet for High Flight, I think it's called. It's a famous 1960s jet, and they do a few minutes, and they talk about it. And the jet is flying, and it's an actual, it's at altitude, and there's no contrails coming off the plane whatsoever. But it does edit in to a shot below, and you see persistent contrails in circles. Now, they've been experimenting for a very, very long time. The list of patents.
Were you saying that the contrails weren't visible from the aircraft, but they were from below it?
No, in this particular edit that I'm talking about, in this particular video of this plane in the 1960s flying, they, for some reason, they cut to below the plane. They pan into a new shot.
Yeah.
And you can see lots of persistent contrails in circles.
Right.
So there's evidence of it in the 60s. But what I'm saying is, yes, there is evidence of it in the past, but certainly not on a daily basis that we see now from the jets that we see flying on a regular basis. We see X's. I mean, you must have seen dramatic.
We just have more jets
X's
flying
and grids in the skies. Oh, so, so they didn't make X's and grids like that on a regular basis like they do now. Why does making more jets fly? I live in rural France. There's not a great deal of pollution around here because there's no industry. So why is it that more planes flying should make X's and lingering contrails in the sky for hours and hours that expand out into clouds and everything else when they never used to do that before? I used to live near the busiest airport near London, and they never used to do that. So let's face it, there were plenty of jets flying in the 80s and the 90s, and they didn't make those X's and grids before.
Right. Max, I'm going to have to ask you to let Bob, go ahead. I just wanted to hear your answer.
Yeah, you would still get X's before, but the issue is that if you've got fewer planes flying, it's less likely for another plane to cross the path of a previous plane's contrail, so it would be
you're saying that flight corridors are more complicated these days because you know that they have different markers on their flights, on their flight paths. They have markers so they don't crash into each other, yeah? So they have different corridors in the sky. Now, to get multiple X's and grids, you have to be at a crossroads or something in the sky in order to be getting consistent X's like that all the time, which obviously must happen in different locations.
Not really. I mean, the altitudes will be different between these two trails, but it's just that one flight path will go across over the top of another one.
Yeah. I don't think you've seen the things that I've seen in the sky yet. But getting back to what you were saying about the fact that there's more aircraft in the sky means that now we've got X's and grids in the sky and persistent trails where we didn't have them before. So you're admitting you can understand that
I'm not saying you didn't see them before, but I'm saying they would probably be less frequent due to the fact that there's less aircraft. And you can correlate seeing more of these trails with seeing more aircraft.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what, when you live near a busy airport like Gatwick, and now I live in rural France, right? I think there were more planes traveling to Gatwick or from Gatwick or even to Heathrow or to many of the other airports where I was living than there are here.
And
so why didn't I see the volume in that location where I lived for many years of my life of air traffic?
If you're near an airport, the planes are going to be flying at lower altitudes, so you're not going to be in the sort of optimal conditions for creating trails.
So does that mean that if when I was in Brighton, I could see all the trails that I could see now, and I videoed lots of X's and crosses in the sky there, that in the past that didn't apply, but now it does? I mean, I'm confused because if you're saying if you're that close to the airport, you shouldn't see all the X's, but now you do. Because when I was just there for recently, in the last month, we videoed it and we were able to say to people when we were trying to raise awareness in the streets, look at those lines, look at those X's and grids in the sky. So they weren't there before when I used to live there for many years. And now they are there, but they're still the same geographical location from the airport.
I see. I see what you mean now.
All right, guys. I see it's getting a bit heated, which is good, actually.
Yeah, it's okay. This is good to try and discuss these and work it out. It's fine.
I agree. So we're going to go for a short music break, and we're going to be right back in 2 minutes. And welcome back. I hope everyone enjoyed that. So the debate was getting a bit heated. I love when that happens. Actually, people get passionate, and that's when we get the best debates. So we're going to move on to the next question, if you guys are okay with that, unless there was something else you wanted to mention.
I think we're okay for the moment.
All right.
Yeah, fine.
So, Max, what do you think the chemtrails actually contain?
Well, there's a patent, the Welsbach patent, which was in 1991. It was for use for geoengineering to combat, for use in solar radiation management to combat global warming, suggests aluminium and barium and strontium and various other things. Now, looking at what I got back in my rainwater analysis, now I'll have to say my rainwater analysis came back at 20 micrograms per liter, and the normal safe amount of aluminium in the air is 0.008 micrograms per liter. Now, one done in London last year was 740 micrograms per liter, and the safe amount of aluminium in the air is 0.008 micrograms. So I would say aluminium, which could be the in the Welsbach patent, it's trimethyl aluminium, right. which I think has been described to be released. It changes, it oxidizes in the temperature of the airplane, of the engine, and then it oxidizes outside once it's left. So, I mean, we only have to go, we can easily assess that whatever's in the rainfall has come from the atmosphere, because it gets here at the point of nucleation through precipitation process. So it's in the atmosphere. How it gets there, that's the thing we need to confirm. Now, that's speculation, isn't it? We've got a patent that says that's what they can do. And we've got strange large amounts of aluminium. Some people will say that's from rocket fuel, because it's used as an accelerant in rocket fuel, as a tracer. We can't be certain. The only way we can absolutely 100% certain is if we can take a conclusive and valid aerial sample from a plane that we believe is chemtrailing. But we found excessively high amounts of aluminium, barium, and strontium. Now, if you look at the ingredients of JP-8 fuel,
why do you attribute it to aircraft sources rather than, say, other sources like cars, factories, any sort of numerous other sources that you could be looking at this? I mean, I assume these air samples you've done are ground-based.
Are you saying you said cars there? Are you saying that aluminium, barium, strontium would come from cars? In the atmosphere, they would be up there at 11,000 meters in the atmosphere.
Not necessarily.
From cars.
I mean, where have you sampled these? Where have you got your air samples from?
Oh no, I didn't say air samples. I said rainwater samples.
Rainwater samples. Sorry.
From outside in my garden, in plastic containers, as per instructions.
But I mean that's
and so I live in the countryside. Other people have done them in London. Other people have done them in Holland. Other people have done them. Well, people are taking rainwater samples who are concerned all around the world, and they're coming back with similar results.
I mean, I also have samples here. Samples statistics here from 1967 showing presence of aluminium and other things in rainwater as far back as 1967.
Well, as I said, they've been experimenting with the patents. If you look at the patents, they go back. They were talking about using aluminium in jet fuel back in the early 60s. So they must have been testing it at different times. So there's lots of reasons why it can be there.
Yeah.
But according to the site that I looked for the safe amounts of aluminium in the atmosphere, I'm trying to find the information, there shouldn't be very much aluminium in the atmosphere.
The thing is, rainwater will pick up sort of any pollutants from the atmosphere, like anywhere in the atmosphere. So you would need to get samples from like higher up in the atmosphere, like air samples or something, to try and to sort of prove your suggestions here. I mean,
I certainly haven't got all the proof here, Bob. If I had all the proof,
please don't talk over each other.
I mean, you can't take a ground rain sample and say that that is evidence of chemtrails.
Something
I mean,
in the atmosphere.
It's evidence that there is pollutants in the atmosphere, but it doesn't show you where they've come from. I mean, you would have to do analysis of, say, air at higher altitudes with, for example, maybe by balloon or something.
It's a good point you've said that, actually, because we're in the process of getting that done now, actually, because some other people who are better qualified than me, who's a climate scientist, he's actually involved in arranging these tests now. Okay. I mean, the thing is, we can't go, or in our limited position, remember I told you that I'm just a builder. Okay. Yeah. Now I can research information and I can document what I see in the skies, and it is quite incredible. And I can research what I can. Now anyone will realise that whatever I'm researching is someone else's information. You know, so it depends on where I'm getting that information from. But when I get my rainwater analysis back and it is excessively high, I don't know if that is definitely coming from the plains, but I do know that what does come from the plains isn't what it was before, because I'm seeing new X's, new persistent trails that just weren't there before. So something is coming from the plains. I can't establish it is definitely what we're finding in the rain, but there are patents and there is a heck of a lot of information about geoengineering. When you start looking into geoengineering, I'm not talking about just a little bit that we see on the TV with David Keith doing his occasional television. I'm talking about decades of research. The amount of scientific documentation about this information is incredible. So clearly they must have at some point have seriously considered doing it and done experiments and have tried it or whatever. So, I mean, it's quite strongly indicative if there's so much scientific research and published journals about what would happen or what might happen, and we can see a big difference in what's happening in the atmosphere. We can see that. We don't need to be a scientist to see that the colour of the sky has changed, these persistent clouds have changed, we're seeing new types of clouds. These cirrus contrail clouds, these
cirrus clouds have been around for a long time.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, let's compare photos then, because what we can see on a regular basis is something that was incredibly rare before, and they had to be in books, collated in books that would say, yeah, you can get this book out from 1960s. Let's find, oh, there's lots of evidence of that. We could go to Cloud Studies in Colour from 1968 from the Imperial College London, and you can see incredible clouds, but I tell you what, we didn't used to see them every day.
But, I mean, that can't... I mean, you can pretty much attribute all of that to just the cloud seeding effects.
Well, this cloud seeding must be a part of it. We know that cloud seeding has been going on for a long time, don't we? Because we know that in 1952, there was a disaster in Lynmouth in Dorset where 35 people were killed because of a rainwater from a cloud seeding experiment. We know companies like Weather Modification Incorporated have set up in 1961 have been cloud seeding all this time. So cloud seeding is obviously a part of this weather modification thing.
Yeah, I mean, all cloud seeding is just causing clouds to form or causing clouds
by spraying aerosols into the atmosphere.
Not necessarily.
An aerosol, it's just a particle, isn't it?
Yeah.
Max, I'm going to have to ask you to please let Bob finish.
Oh, sorry.
No problem.
I mean,
it's just
causing clouds to form, and just the sort of pressure differences on the wings and sort of the fact that an aircraft traveling through the air should be sufficient to cause clouds to form, and that sort of additional aircraft traffic causing more cloud seeding is just what brings these is what causes all these clouds and sort of additional cloud formations you're seeing.
Right. And personally, I might not be a scientist, but you mentioned earlier that the finding of aluminium in rainwater meant that it was in the stratosphere. I'm not very knowledgeable, but I remember learning that rainwater actually comes from groundwater. It's kind of sucked up into the atmosphere, so maybe it could have gathered up from there as well.
Yeah. Yeah, the rainwater doesn't have to get... The water for the rain doesn't have to get all the way up to the stratosphere. A lot of clouds form at fairly low levels just from the water rising.
Right. You can go ahead, Max. I didn't tell
it's
you.
It's okay. No, you know, I don't know. I would like to know what the average rainwater measurements of aluminium was in the past. When we come across sites, government authorized sites that tell you what the normal amount of aluminium should be, whether it's in groundwater or the air or rain, and the results that we're getting seem to be much higher. I wonder why they say the normal amount should be this amount. You know, if the normal amount is a set amount, you would imagine that's because that's the average. And if now the average has increased a great deal, that means there's an extra amount come into that whole calculation.
Yeah, but
so
no,
where's the extra that, amount that just, come that, from? I mean, well, if it's just going up and down pollution. Because of the right... Sorry, sorry.
Oh, sorry, I was just saying that. On you go.
So just extra pollution. And that, is that extra pollution from coal-fired potash power stations? Where has this extra amount of aluminium come from?
Well, I wouldn't be able to say sort of definitively where, and well, of course, neither would you. But there's many, many sources of pollution that you'd have to discount before you can attribute it to any one of them.
Well, hopefully, when we start, I mean, this is one of the complications about just taking aerial samples with these weather balloons. They're not definitive enough that they've come from the aeroplanes. What we need really is an air sample with a plane following a plane that we believe is chemtrailing, to take an air sample of that trail to be more definitive. So this is an elusive problem. But
I mean, you would, if you were to test at a high enough altitude, it would still be sufficient because you get the dispersal, and so. Just getting high altitude air samples would be sufficient to disprove your cause.
Pipeline. That is getting organised, so that would be something. I mean, for me personally, I'd like to see a video of a plane following another plane with a trail behind it, like we see sometimes on YouTube, and actually getting a sample of that. But like I told you before, a friend of mine who is a climate scientist, he is arranging to have the high altitude aerial weather balloon air samples done. So maybe they'll come back and there'll be more. Indicative of what we're looking for, or maybe they'll prove that there's nothing up there at all.
Have you also had groundwater, or like from rivers, tested for?
Well, I personally haven't. Although I am quite fortunate that a friend of mine, he works at a water company in the UK, and he has now come round to thinking that I'm not crazy, and he is he's going to find out a long historical. Get historical reports for me to find out what the changes are. So he's only just told me that yesterday. So hopefully, in the near future, I shall be able to get some reports on that to see if there's anything indicative.
So yeah. We're gonna go for another little music break while everyone takes a breath. So here we go.
All right, welcome back.
Yes, welcome back, everybody. So we're going to just go ahead and ask a few more questions. Then we're going to take callers for the second hour of the show, if that's all right with everyone.
That's fine. Actually, I did wonder if it was okay to bring Bob back to the earlier break. This has been the second break we just had. Just before we left that break,
right.
I was explaining to you that I'd just been on a trip to Brighton. And it was part of my Juggaboom awareness tour where I was trying to present what I know or what I think I know and at least let my pictures do the talking, really. One of the things I said to you, I was able to point out to people up in the skies at the time of these persistent lines and X's in the sky. But years before, those things didn't exist over Brighton. And we then went to the break. So you said that when you were near an airport, the altitude of the planes would be far too low that they wouldn't be able to leave those trails. So I was wondering, what is your explanation for the fact that the trails are there, and I've filmed them and I've photographed them, and there's lots of evidence that they're there over Brighton. What's your explanation for them being there now?
Contrails over Brighton.
Yeah, because they're quite close to the airport.
Well, planes in the landing in the pattern for that airport might be too low to have contrails. They might not. It all depends on like important sort of atmospheric conditions. I mean, if the humidity is like too high, there's too much cloud or whatever, you might not get contrails forming. But or if it's too warm, you might not get contrails forming. So it's much easier for the sort of the high altitude jets to form contrails.
So at the lower altitude jets, what are the conditions necessary?
I would need to look into sort of the exact details, but it'll be a sort of a variety of atmospheric conditions, like the temperature will have to be right, the sort of humidities will have to be
and
right.
And what would they be?
I'm not sure. I've not really looked in sort of in detail on this sort of for the sort of exact sort of formation conditions required. But I mean, you've also got to have the sort of the sunlight in the right way for the sun to reflect off the ice crystals of the trail and reflect back towards Earth.
So what happens if it was quite a cloudy sky, but you can see a bright white trail underneath the cloud and the sun's behind the cloud?
I mean, there's lots of ways for these trails to form.
I agree. I'm aware of that. I'm curious to know how your explanation.
I mean, that could just be the aircraft. I mean, there's also water that's going to come out of the out of the engines after combustion. Mm-hmm. So you could get that forming a conventional cloud behind the aircraft.
Yeah. So what are the humidity conditions you were talking about? They must be specific because they don't happen all the time, do they? So what are they? What are those conditions for the humidity? What should the humidity be? Because contrails or chemtrails are not formed all the time, are they? We see lots of planes. Well, I used to see lots of planes without them whatsoever. Occasionally, I still see that. But obviously, sometimes you see a contrail. So what are the humidity conditions? What should it be?
Well, I don't know what the conditions would need to be. I would need to actually sort of look for sort of research into sort of into atmospheric research on the formation of these trails. But
okay,
you get condensation just from sort of decreases in pressure and everything, and from especially the air pressure changes from the wingtip vortices.
Mm-hmm.
But
those are different, aren't they? I mean, those wingtip vortices are just very short-lived little vapor trails, aren't they? They don't persist. They don't expand out into clouds, and they don't leave great big bright white long persistent trails.
I mean, you've also got the trails from the exhaust with sort of water sort of coming out of the fuel as it's burnt.
Mm. Yeah, but that doesn't last for very long, does it? Once that's gone, it's gone. So what's the temperature likely to be to form a contrail? You know, what altitude there must be temperature changes. The higher up you go, it gets colder. So if planes are approaching Gatwick Airport, what sort of temperature is the minimum? Or, you know, it must pass a threshold where you'll get a contrail. So what is that temperature?
That's not something I've really looked into sort of to research.
Okay.
All right. So we're going to move on to the next question. Do you think you could explain a bit more what you think is the best evidence, like the best of the best evidence to chemtrails being actually real and dangerous?
Well, for me personally, it's having seen what I've seen. When you see planes flying, doing erratic turns, and then when you look at flight radar, you see a zigzag pattern, a flight path that's a zigzag, and you can see the big turn in the sky. You know that that's and it's a big white plane. It's not like a little military jet doing a acrobatics or something. It's quite amazing to see. So for me, really, it's personally what I've seen in the sky being so dramatically different to anything that I've seen in my many years of working outside. So that's quite dramatic. As far as health concerns, as Bob was saying, we can't establish whether or not they're definitely coming from the planes, and it could just be from multiple sources. It's difficult. But we do know that aluminium, which is now found in excessively high amounts in rain, is very dangerous. There's lots of health reports about Alzheimer's, about various illnesses related to aluminium. I mean, even if you look at the Gulf War syndrome, aluminium was a main part of that, and there's all sorts of problems where it leads to various illnesses. So I mean, the amount of research being done right now into the effects of aluminium on the human body, it's quite a large body of work to try and read through. I mean, there's a great deal of illnesses, and it's all negative. So we know that aluminium is dangerous.
How is aluminium connected to Gulf War syndrome?
Aluminium hydroxide injections were used for the soldiers for vaccinations. But of course, who knows if that's in all vaccinations? But that's a document I'm looking at the moment.
Someone here is mentioning that it could be due to acid rain.
The acid rain. What could be? Sorry, I'm not quite sure I understood that question. That comment. In relevance, what to the amount of aluminium?
Yes, I think so. It was someone in the chat who mentioned it and provided a link. So I'm just trying to keep up with everything while you guys debate.
Okay. Well, I think actually that the concept that aluminium will make people ill is quite a well-known fact. I mean, even the Wright-Patterson Air Force Laboratory, they did a research into the effects of aluminium oxide into the alveoli, the grape-like clusters inside the lungs. And they showed that just 5 micrograms per litre of aluminium oxide will affect the functions of the cells, and they therefore, you know, make the creature ill. That was obviously in mice, but that was only 5 micrograms. Now, when you're getting 740 micrograms in the water in London, in the rainwater.
Wait, of that particular form of aluminium?
Pardon?
Your rainwater measurement.
740 micrograms per litre.
But that was in rainwater. Your previous study refers to, I assume, air quality, because it's talking about lungs.
Yeah, and
they're not comparable.
It depends.
Because that study relies on inhaled aluminium oxide. So aluminium oxide, and you'd have to compare air samples.
Well, exactly, you're right. And going on the idea that the rain is made in the atmosphere. And that's a good point we might get into. I mean, I need further proof that I haven't got the complete picture. If I had the whole complete picture, then, you know, I'm sure there'd be a lot more information flowing out there, because the problem is this information is withheld, isn't it? I mean, it's quite difficult to get through to the geoengineers at Oxford University, which I've been trying to get in contact, because when I look at their research documents, I can see they've been doing it for many, many years. I know that the British government have been researching it for a long time, because they've just, in 2009, they had the 120-odd pages, 140-page document on the regulations of geoengineering using solar radiation management, which is injecting these heavy metals into the atmosphere. Now, to get to that level, a fifth report, these reports are quite comprehensive things. They're not just written in a week. It's the fifth one. And if they're talking about regulation, if they're talking about making it law or bringing in the rules, that means they're at an advanced stage. So we know that there's definitely a great deal of research gone into this. So, you know, we only have to look at what's going on in the sky and see the dramatic differences, close to the airports even, and see that all the research has been done, and see that the governments are at an advanced stage of regulating this and trying to introduce this on a global scale by setting up groups like the Solar Radiation Government Initiative, which is a organisation specifically set up to petition foreign governments to accept solar radiation management, which is their preferred option to combat global warming. Are we in agreement?
I have not seen any of that stuff, so I have no idea.
Well, that's okay. It's there. It's quite easy. If you go to www.srmgi.org, that is the government organisation, the Solar Radiation Management Government Initiative, that's been set up. And when you look at this, you will find out they've had conferences in Latin America, they've had conferences in Africa, where various different scientific representatives of those governments have been invited to conferences, and they try to push the concept that geoengineering should be allowed to go ahead because there are trans-border issues with the regulation of geoengineering. So if we're at an advanced stage.
Well, in that case, why would geoengineering necessarily be a bad thing if it's to combat global warming?
Well, I came across something from a Finnish, I think it was Finnish, the Nordic Sciences, basically where they archaeologists had found that the Vikings had been growing barley in Greenland up until the 13th century. And then there was a mini ice age during the Middle Ages, during onwards. And so basically, it was warmer before, and then it got colder. And that's relatively easy to prove. So we know that the climate goes through changes. It's got nothing to do with man-made activity. Global warming and the changes. So let's face it, it's 5 degrees today. I'm in France. It's not warmer. Global warming, if we're going to move into this, global warming is a fraud. We've had 3 ClimateGate scandals at the UK Climate Research Centre at the University of East Anglia, where they've been hacked and been proved that they have been fixing and skewing the data to fit a particular model. 3 times. Not once. Not once it was in the paper. 3 times. So we know there is a scandal.
I feel like we're going a bit of on a tangent here. I mean, we're a bit far away from actual.
Well, chemicals. I don't know. Global warming is quite linked to geoengineering, because geoengineering is the solution to a problem of global warming, and geoengineering has got all the documentation that people are concerned about chemtrails. So it is definitely intrinsically linked.
Fair enough. So we're going to have a small jingle break, and we're going to be right back in a few minutes. Welcome back to the show, everyone. I hope everyone is enjoying it so far. I know I am. So we're gonna take callers for the next part of the show. So if everyone has comments to make or wants to join the conversation, you're free to join. Prajna is posting the links from time to time in the channel. So in the meantime, I know I kind of interrupted you guys for the break earlier. So if you want to continue, be my guest. Bob?
Where were we? I can't even remember where we were.
We were talking about the geoengineering and global warming.
Ah, yeah. That was it.
I personally, I'm not too sure what the geoengineering on the sun and solar radiation has to do with the chemtrails, but hopefully we can get some enlightenment on that.
Well, I think the suggestion is that the so-called chemtrails are dispersing the geoengineering chemicals into the atmosphere, but I don't see any proof of that happening.
Right. Kit, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well,
I've just missed that. I'm sorry.
The only comment I really have for this entire aluminium debate is that aluminium is incredibly common in nature, and it. I've seen the research on Alzheimer's, but it didn't. It said quite specifically in the report that they couldn't determine whether it was the aluminium was cause or effect of the Alzheimer's. And yeah, I'm not convinced on the aluminium part that it's being sprayed and is dangerous to us, but. But I'm willing to learn more.
What I was wondering about this chemtrail thing is, how are these aircraft being configured to, as you suggest, distribute these sort of chemicals?
Well, that's actually that's quite easy to explain, because that's already been very well explored because of the geoengineering research. I mean, basically, you just need a few tanks. The trimethyl aluminium can be added with a supplementary tank to the fuel lines. And it doesn't have to take up a great deal of space. It's a supplementary addition to fuel. One thing I want to say about the aluminium before I forget, is it okay to say something about the aluminium?
Yeah.
That Monsanto and DuPont and various other biotech companies have all been developing new aluminium-resistant seed lines, including trees, well, every single living plant. They're working on aluminium-resistant seeds. So I would just like to point out, aluminium is an abundant metal. I think it's like an element. I think it's like the third most abundant metal in the Earth's crust. It is widely abundant, but it's normally in a safe form that shouldn't be dangerous to plants. Now, why would these biotech companies be making these aluminium-resistant seed lines now?
Because, if they are making these seed lines of seeds, or at least patenting them, that probably suggests that they're actively sort of researching pesticides. I mean, these companies make money by making crops that are resistant to some pesticides and not to others, so you can kill weeds easily. But that's
suggesting you're going to use aluminium to kill the weeds?
I mean, I'm not saying it's necessarily what they're going to do, but if that's what they're patenting, it would suggest that they're probably looking into that as a possibility, because you tend to patent things pretty early on in the process.
You do know that Monsanto was the company that made Agent Orange and the cloud seeding elements for the Vietnam War for Operation Popeye.
Yes.
So they're intrinsically linked together with spraying things into the atmosphere and the petrochemical industry. So, you know, they have been involved for a long time.
The thing is, with Agent Orange, it wasn't the Agent Orange that was dangerous. But I can't be bothered explaining it, really.
And you know about the Korean War and the sprays in the Korean War.
Agent Orange was all down to a manufacturing process that was wrong, leading to a dioxin contamination of the batch. So that's simple.
It's an accident. Okay. But you know, in the Korean War, that many veterans were able to sue and successfully get payouts because they developed multiple sclerosis because of a bacteria that was used in aerosol spraying that they were able to identify had direct links to multiple sclerosis that lots of the veterans had developed, and they got payouts. So, you know, we know that they do spray things into the atmosphere that are dangerous. They've been doing this for a long time. When we know that the British government, for 20-odd years, was spraying zinc cadmium into the atmosphere.
Anyway, I think we're getting quite far off topic now anyway.
Well, I'm just trying to demonstrate that the governments are capable of spraying things into the atmosphere without public consultation and knowledge.
Having the capacity to do so doesn't mean they actually are, though. We would need more solid proof to be able to make the claim. At least that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, but I think the regulation is almost at its final stage now, after many years of deliberation, that basically geoengineering is almost public. I think, you know, so they have been doing it for many years. I mean, isn't that quite a strong suggestion that they have been at this for a long time?
Sure, publicly and probably properly regulated. I don't have the data with me. If it's public, it's most likely very much regulated.
They want to regulate it. This is the problem, because they've got transborder issues.
I'm sorry, I think Bob's backyard wanted to barge in a bit.
Okay.
Yeah, well, two things. One, pertaining to everybody out there listening, if you give out the phone numbers, we've got a hell of a lot more people on the stream than in the chat room. If you want me to, well, I'll do that. If you do want to call the show, and the callers who tried to get in the first half, please ring back. and we'll get you on. The number is 0161. This is from the UK, okay? 0161 298-0298. And from outside the UK, it's plus 44-161-298-0298. Or you can Skype the show directly through Bob's Backyard. And of course, there is the chat room, as was mentioned before, and that's on the AnonNet, and the channel is called Bob's Backyard. Put a hash in front of that. Now, my question to all of you, to the panel, really, is why suddenly, now, I've lived in Manchester, around the Manchester area, on the east of Manchester. I'm not actually officially on the flight path, although we do get a few going over us directly on occasion, but we are not officially on the flight path. So the majority of planes I can see in my area, but like I say, they don't come directly over me. The area of Cheshire in Duckingfield is completely off the flight path. In fact, if planes go over there, you can report them and take the number and actually get a compensation for it. So bearing that in mind, why does, after the planes have gone over, the sky turn grey and black the sun out? What's the explanation for this? I'm not saying it's the New World Order and they're trying to terraform the planet so the reptilian aliens can take over, right? I'm not. Okay, I'm not going down that line. But I'm not saying something isn't happening, neither. Something in the environment here around Manchester has changed. Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Like I say, it is different. There's no doubt about it. And I can hear what Max is saying. I really can. I worked outside a lot, Max, building trade for a while before I got into computers. A lot of roofing work. You're aware of it. You're always looking at the sky, especially when you're on a roof. Trust me, in Manchester. Right? you're always fucking looking at the sky. You never know what's going to hit you. And to be honest, you're not worrying about chemtrails too much, but you're aware of the sky. You really are. People who work outdoors, farmers and so forth. When you talk to them, they've all seen this, what I'll call a phenomenon. Something is happening and we're not being told. So that's my question.
Have you got any idea sort of like a date, or was there any noticeable sort of time this changed, or is it possibly just people remembering things differently?
Oh, yeah. I've
no doubt, Bob.
I wouldn't dispute that, my memory. I could be having a delusionary implanted memory from Tavistock. I wouldn't dispute that, I really could. It could have been programmed from the TV. But look, man, the sky did... These contrails never joined together, right? They never joined together. They never formed a blanket cloud and blocked the sky out. That never happened, bro. It never happened. You show me photographs when that's happened in the past anywhere on Earth, right? You come to Manchester... You spend a month here, I'll guarantee you see it at least a dozen times out of the month. It happens on a regular basis. The clouds from these planes join together and they form, best I can call, is a blanket cloud. What's going on?
Well, there is sometimes from NASA, they talk about something called global dimming. And they say that contrails from aeroplanes have caused a 20% increase in global dimming. Now, I think that's a generous offering, because here in France, this year, even in the mainstream media, they reported the darkest winter on record. And that's the same in Germany, by the way. In France, they said, on average, there was a 50% increase in cloud cover nationally, and in some places, up to 80% extra cloud. Now, we are now seeing that these planes, their trails are expanding out and forming huge amounts of cloud.
The weather is incredibly complex. We still haven't managed to get a model that accurately reflects the current weather conditions. So, I mean, just because you don't remember something happening from the past doesn't mean it's necessarily a new phenomenon.
It's never been recorded. It was never recorded. That's all I'm saying.
We can show see me the photographs. Have changed.
Show me the photographs, right? When that happened in the past, I'm right. Look, I'm not saying it is being done by anything, like I said, man. What I am saying is something's changed. That's all I'm saying that didn't happen. And I get clouds can form, Max. I do that. But these clouds aren't forming naturally. These clouds are forming from whatever's behind it, whether it is natural clouds or not. Right, if it could be ice vapor forming, we don't know.
Well, I mean, it's entirely.
There's that many chemicals.
It's entirely.
there's that many chemicals being released into the atmosphere now, who bleeding knows where they're all coming from?
Well, I suppose it's entirely possible that it is just that there's more planes in the sky, and those planes are just sort of causing the sort of clouds to form sort of faster than they would have otherwise normally formed.
So, yeah, I mean, just following that for one second, though. If I can just for one second, it'd be quick, this, Mike.
Yeah.
If what you're saying is right, and we're all aware that the blockage of vitamin B1 created by natural sunlight has a medical effect on us, then you're actually agreeing that the increased use of planes, whatever's being formed, is causing a medical...
Well, the amount of sunlight exposure you need isn't actually that much.
No, the dark period you need is very important. But, yeah, you wouldn't dispute that we're getting less sunlight exposure and less sunlight exposure.
Well, I haven't seen data to sort of support that or anything.
Your entire argument is that they're just forming more clouds. And if more clouds block out the sun, because we all know black clouds block out the sunlight, that's, are we debating that now, Duncan?
Well, what I think
I'm just trying to say that it is a possibility that it's just more clouds forming because of the planes.
And it's a possibility that Max is right and his chemicals being put in there to poison us. It's a possibility.
Is it as likely, though?
Excuse me?
I think we can agree that there's extra clouds.
People wouldn't spray stuff into the... Come on, Richard.
We already know that. We know they've done that many times.
Would the chemical industries put poison into the air? No, man. They would never do that, ever.
And
they've never
push
done
us
that.
Onto GMOs.
Excuse me. They'd never do that, would they?
Now, getting back to the cloud and the global dimming and vitamin D3... And the fact we're only supposed to need 20 minutes exposure to the sun in order to get our vitamin D3. Rickets is back. Rickets is a big problem. And in fact, if most of us look at our fingernails now, we'll probably see ribs on the back of the fingernails that we really shouldn't have. It's a vitamin D3 deficiency. Now, why is rickets back?
Well, if I may interrupt, that's because people are spending more and more time indoors.
And when they are outside, it's very, very cloudy and we can't get the sunlight anymore. I mean, there's no debate about how much sunlight we're getting now and how much increase in cloud there is, because that's very well documented.
Well, I know that I'm getting...
Increase. Pardon?
I know that I'm getting plenty of sun here right now.
Where actually. Are you? Are you in Australia?
I'm in Canada, actually.
Well, your government refused the USA the rights to spray. Your government refused them.
Now, in Canada, they spray a lot.
Well, they may now, but the United States of America the Canadian government rejected the American spraying over there.
Where do you get that documentation from?
Oh, I'll get it, Matt. I'll go find it. That's way pre-9/11.
I've also come across
the document. They were also, the United States of America were also spraying the people with pesticides, which killed thousands of old people on a regular basis.
In California,
wasn't it? Go and check it out. You know, they do it on a regular basis. That kills people. They spray stuff. If people die. Oh, well, we're going to kill the insects.
Well, if you provide links to actually document those claims, we'll be happy to put them on the blog.
Google it.
That's not an answer. The burden of proof is on the person making the claim.
Oh, you're making the claim that it doesn't exist, Richard, but without any substantial evidence.
If I would tell you that
you've gathered from the internet, I'm saying go to the same source.
No, I'm sorry, that's not how it works. I could tell you that Jesus visits me on a unicorn every night, and I could say, well, it's your burden to prove me wrong.
You're actually saying that the United States have not given out licenses to be able to spray pesticides on the locust population in the United States of America. You're telling me that doesn't happen?
Actually, I don't have enough information. I was asking for more information.
Are pesticides sprayed by planes?
Yes, they are.
Thank you very much indeed. Are pesticides harmful to humans?
Yes.
Not necessarily.
Well, all right then. Some of them are.
Yes, I don't think anyone could disagree with that.
There you go. So we're not disagreeing here. We have got a consensus that stuff is being sprayed and it is harmful to people. Right, so I don't think...
Well, I don't know if it's still being sprayed.
Well, it has been, and there's a good chance. We have no evidence to say that it has not been sprayed. We've got demonstrations going on just recently to try and ban chemicals they're trying to spray. Major insecticides, which are directly linked to wiping out the bee population. Are we now going to see we don't no longer need bees to pollinate plants? Come on.
No, of course not.
This is not in the long term.
50% of the bee population is gone.
It's causing massive long-term effects. If many people can't look at it in the long term, they live in the short term, and I respect that. But for those of us that say we can look into the long term, let's stop coming up with these short-term ideologies. That is a preposterous nature that you're actually going to try and debate that they're not doing this, and there's stacks of evidence, and then you tell me I have to provide it? I have to cure your ignorance with my time?
Well, you're making the claim.
I'm not making a claim. I'm not making a claim. All right? Okay, then the governments do not ever spray anything in the air that has ever harmed anybody.
No, but we're talking about chemtrails
here. That's now taking an argument ad absurdum.
Yeah, we're talking about chemtrails specifically aimed at killing people here. We're not talking about spraying chemicals on the crops.
What is a chemtrail? Well, the argument here that I think Max is putting forward, because I'm getting a bit confused with it. Max's argument is there is something inside there that's not helping people. I didn't hear Max say they're doing it to kill people.
Yeah, I just was about to say that I didn't bring that into the agenda. I didn't say that was a part of it. No, I'm talking about weather modification here. Oh, and also, there's a food supply issue, and they're trying to push people on to having to use GMO foods. Now, I can directly prove that at the moment in the EU, there is a very, very difficult law that they're trying to force where people won't be able to grow heirloom seeds, which is part of the United Nations Agenda 21. I know we didn't want to move away from chemtrails, but if you toxify the soil and you can't grow your own seeds, and then there's a law to stop you from growing heirloom seeds, which is now they're trying to push this through, you are left with no other choice but to grow GMO foods. Think about it. Who is making the money? It's not natural anymore. You can't grow your own food. Legally, you can't grow your own food. And scientifically, you can't grow your own food because the soil's changing.
Well, I see plenty of community gardens. I mean, they are legally growing their own food.
Oh, yes,
people,
but there's a new law they're trying to pass.
So why is aquaponics being blocked by the educational policy throughout the United Kingdom then? I've got hardcore evidence for that. I am the fact. You won't find that on eBay. I was the guy who did it. I put it into the educational policy throughout England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales. It was accepted as a cross-curriculum activity. Why is it being stopped?
I don't know about the UK, but I know that in the US and in Canada, there are plenty of people growing their own food and nobody's stopping them.
I didn't say that. There's loads of people getting stopped. You keep coming out with these claims, bro. That's completely unsubstantiated.
What?
You know, it's all right to prove people aren't doing stuff. How do you prove they're not doing something? It's impossible, man. It's a circular argument you're using.
It's not true anyway. People are being arrested.
No. I'm sorry. You're not going to attack me this way.
It's not an attack. You're the one who brought up the attack on that Max was saying, that people, and the argument here was...
No, I simply asked for documentation, and you went on a wild rant. You're very emotional about this.
No, not at all, man. I have no emotional connection to this situation whatsoever. None at all. I've got no emotion.
Well, you get pretty angry. I mean, I simply asked for more documentation so I could look at it. That's all I asked for at first. And
there, do you need documentation to know that pesticides have been banned in Britain just recently? Listen to Dark City Radio. We've covered it. Mark Mann's covered it. Listen to the archives. It's been covered. We had what she called the famous designer, Vivian Westwood, speaking out against it. I mean, where do you want us to go with the information? We've done it. We've covered it here on Dark City Radio. I don't have to go on Google and look at stuff. I've done it. People have brought it.
Well, on this show, we make claims and then we observe evidence that supports the claims. That's the whole premise of the show.
Exactly. So the evidence here that Maxi seems to be putting forward, right, part of it is,
right,
and correct me, Max, if I'm wrong here, mate, because it just seems to be there's a bit of an ambush going on. It seems to be Max has not said, up until just recently, anything about any kind of genocide by the governments. He's saying there's some kind of weather change going on. That's what he's saying.
And it's weather change, and it's about food production as well. Now, I can substantiate and I can provide the evidence right now about the law they're trying to pass for restricting. You cannot. They want to pass a law that will stop people exercising the thousands of years tradition of growing heirloom seeds in the EU bloc. Now, you can, I can get that link for you, and I will provide that link for you. I will also provide a link for you how an American woman had to go to jail because she grew tomatoes in her garden, but because of the United Nations Agenda 21 and the
which is only a suggestion and not really forced implementation, by the way.
Well, hang on a second, you might say that because that's the way
it is.
Hang on. What you're talking about heirloom crops, I sort of know some of the bits about this issue.
Looking up the law now?
No, I'm not looking up the law, but I know a bit about the sort of background of this, and it mostly relates to patented genetically modified organisms and whether or not someone who uses these patented seeds has the right, sort of after their crop, to mostly for grain crops, so say they're growing wheat or something, it relates to whether they can keep back some of their crop to replant the next year. And it's currently in the courts, whether or not it's legal to do this under the licensing agreements from the companies. Also, it relates to using grain stores where people can purchase seeds from other farmers and whether or not they're covered by patent law.
Okay, well, I've just looked up a link on Natural News, and it's from, their link is to the EU Commission, and it's about growing all vegetable seeds. Do you want to look at this?
Sure, but I know that
Natural News
has published a lot of bullshit in the past, though. But if they have a link to the actual policy, I will look at it, sure.
Well, my other point, I didn't know we were going to talk about this. If I had known, I would have gone to the EU and tried to find the actual link for myself, because I didn't know we were going to talk about this.
No, me neither, actually.
No, we were hoping to try and
stay on. Actually, for the documentation purposes, we do have the blog, and you can both Max and Bob and everybody else can submit their links whenever after the show, or their references whenever after the show. It doesn't have to be while we're live on the air, and I'll put them up on the blog. And it would be great if you, with your link, could put a little bit of text to describe what it is, so we don't just have like 1,000 links that nobody can see what is.
I've actually found the EU the proposal for the law now, so I can give you the link right now so people can have a look at this for themselves right now. It's ec.europa.eu/DGS/health. The little space, it's not a hyphen, the little line, I don't know what you call that. consumer/pressroom/docs/proposal, the little space line, whatever it's called, APHP, little space dash en.pdf, and that's 147 pages, and it gives you the abstract at the beginning, so that will clear up that particular issue there. And it is about vegetable propagating, planting material. I think it's quite in-depth, and it's not simply about whether or not you've got a GMO crop there by accident.
That's what all this. That's what all the heirloom crop laws relate to. It's all about protecting patents on registered GMOs.
Yes, do you know what's happening to farmers with the GMO protection and the Monsanto Act in America and the protection for biotech companies rather than the protection of ordinary everyday growers?
And the last time I checked, the case regarding the grain elevator and the grain store stuff was still in the courts pending appeal or whatever, or pending judgment.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Well, I can't comment on this particular 147-page document.
It's
the first time I've seen this.
But it's all basically civil suits of companies. As you say, Monsanto's one of them. There's a few other ones that I can't remember the names of. But
there's 10 of them.
It's all the sort of GMO manufacturers. They're sort of suing farmers because they're claiming they infringed on their patented crops.
Well, actually, If we read this, the impact assessment concludes that no single option succeeds in achieving objectives in review of efficient, effective, coherent manner, and suggests, in line with stakeholder opinion, a preferred option which combines elements, option 2, 4, you have to read the whole thing, but basically, this combination aims at striking a balance between flexibility for professional operators, biodiversity, this... I think basically it's saying we want to make sure that nothing can attack our profit. And this is why if the soils are changing because they're spraying chemicals in the atmosphere and they have a patent to react to the problem, if they have the solution because chemicals have been sprayed into the soils and the soils can be measured to be changed, and that soils normally that would take up nutrients can no longer do it because there's too much aluminium, additional aluminium, stopping them from taking up nutrients, then you're going to have to rely on the GMOs. So by bringing in legislation like this, it enforces a situation where basically you're going to need to use GMOs, and they're just making sure they've cornered the market.
All right. Actually, I got stuck in the middle of your link there. If you could put it in the Skype chat, I will put it on the blog. And I will also put it in the IRC chat. And I would like to remind the listeners that they can call the show. They can call on the landline. Is it 00161-298-0298? And we'll be happy to take your call.
And on this note, we're going to take a short music break, and we're going to be back in a few minutes. And we're back on the show. So as we were listening to the music, I was looking at a paper that was arguing regarding the aluminum content in rainwater. And there was actually a good question there. Could the samples possibly just be contaminated with the vast, and I mean really vast amounts of aluminum compounds in nature? Because it's the most one of the most common elements in nature.
Well, I would say I'd consider that myself. But when you get normal amounts, I imagine that an organization, I haven't looked this up while in the break, but I think it's ATR, whatever, the American Association for Toxic Regulation or whatever it is, they devise what should be a normal amount. Now, that normal amount surely must be the average. And if the samples are vastly in excess of the average, that would say that that's no longer normal. So is it, if it's just coming from nature, then there has to be a shift in nature because they've decided, they've established the average, what they call normal. So that's simply it, isn't it?
Right.
How many samples have you had tested and... Have you sampled from different locations?
Do you know how many samples there are, how many chemtrail people there are that are concerned that have actually gone to the trouble of taking rainwater samples? We're talking hundreds, if not thousands. Personally, three.
All the same area or from sort of different areas?
And my ones are all in the same area, yes. My personal ones from outside. But there are many, many people that have done this because there's a lot of people willing to spend the money out because it's like a conclusive thing. You read all the things, what they say about the various patents and the geoengineering and what people like geoengineeringwatch.org are pushing. So, you know, you read the information that's available and you look at... you substantiate that by then checking what the geoengineers themselves are talking about, and we can look at the patents and what they're going to use, and then you can see that there's something above the average in the rainwater. Now, why would the rainwater amounts say the average amount should be this is normal, and then it consistently through the people that have taken the trouble to do these independent tests come back with excessively high amounts? You know, I mean, that means the average is thrown, isn't it?
Well, I think you do have a legitimate concern, and I'd be actually interested in seeing more research being done into that. I wouldn't go as far as making wild claims about it, but I'd be definitely interested in seeing more research being done into that field.
I mean, the problem is because aluminium is abundant and it is in many things. I mean, some people have talked about having blood tests and having hair tests.
You would need to have the speciation of the aluminium compounds you're finding analysed and find out which aluminium compounds are actually in the samples.
Right.
Because, I mean, different aluminium compounds could come from different things, and a lot of analysis will only sort of be looking for the presence of aluminium, not specific species of aluminium compounds.
Well, I didn't even know there were multiple species, so
I mean, like, I mean, you've got aluminium oxide, but you've got more than one aluminium oxide.
Yeah.
And
so what tests can we actually the other do? Aluminium to be specific, what tests can we actually do?
That's an interesting question.
There's a few things you could probably do. I'm not sure what would be the best for the particular compound you're looking at, but there's various things like GCMS, which can be used for analysing chemicals, or various other analytical tests.
Okay, well, that's getting quite exotic. I mean, I didn't even know.
Yeah. I mean, that's a
test, but I'm very interested because I would like to get conclusive samples.
It's just sort of typical stuff that an analytical lab will do if you tell them what you're looking for.
Oh, so any laboratory, if I say to them next time, I'd like you to test for aluminium, but can you use a GCMS variant?
They would usually recommend you on the best sort of tests for the compounds you're looking for, because different types of machines are better for different things. And
I'm getting excited here. I really want to know how I can get a conclusive analysis done.
You just what talk should to, I be talk asking to any for? Well, you talk to an analytical lab and tell them what you're looking for is the important thing. Or
okay, tell like them try methylene aluminium, that type of thing.
Yeah, and tell them that's the sort of thing you're looking for.
I mean, I could go to the Welsbach patent, couldn't I, and look at the metals that they're proposing to use in that in 1991 and say, okay, can you look for that type of aluminium, exactly that type?
And you sort of need to tell them sort of what sort of compounds to look for, otherwise they can sort of to help them sort of choose the sort of best analysis to use.
Oh, that's good. That's great. That's good news. That's a good heads up.
There are a lot of different analytical sort of chemistry things you can use.
Okay.
Care to elaborate?
Well, it gets fairly complex quickly, but it's...
Will all laboratories have this equipment?
Yeah, it's fairly standard stuff for a lab to have. I mean, gas chromatography is very useful for mostly organic compounds or soluble things. For your inorganics, you might need to look at other sort of analysis.
Well, I think we're looking for nanoparticles of aluminium oxide, aren't we? Because trimethyl aluminium, what I understand, after it converts, it becomes aluminium oxide, O3, doesn't it? ALO, whatever it is, O3. And I'm no scientist, so I could easily be wrong. But, I mean, that's a particular type of a nanoparticle, a nano-oxide of metal, isn't it, of aluminium. So what would we be looking for that? If we were to say that...
Nanoparticles is when things get different and weird.
Yes.
Because nanochemistry isn't about the compound.
Because it behaves very differently at aluminium at nano level, doesn't it? Things have different properties and different actions at that scale.
Nanoparticles is all about it being really small, and you get some really cool effects with the nanochemistry. You can make nano prisms. So same compound that's used in these prisms, and the different size of the prism causes the solution to be a different color when it's dissolved, just purely based on the size of the prisms that you've created in nanoparticles.
Yeah. So nanotechnology is quite an interesting development, isn't it? I mean, it's been going on for many years, isn't it? Like almost 50 years, I think. But in the last 20 years, they've made big developments, haven't they?
Nanochem is quite recent. I mean, you're only talking, it's only really got big in the last sort of 10, 15 years. it's still very sort of new and cutting edge stuff.
Yeah, that's what's public, isn't it? What does it take to? Because I mean, there's a great deal of aluminium oxide in nanoparticles you can buy. Do you know all around the world?
Yeah.
There's all kinds of suppliers that will, literally many countries actually, you can buy lots of trimethylene aluminium, and you can buy just nanoparticles of aluminium oxide. You can buy it. It's in miniature, but tiny little black spherical spheres, they describe it. But as you say, they can be just slightly changed, and it will totally change the colour of it, and it's the prism you were describing there. Yeah. Nanotechnology, basically, it can be altered, can't it? So it has different properties.
The properties in nanochemistry, and anyway, come from the size of the particles and the way they interact, because at the scales you talk about in nanochemistry, all the intermolecular forces start to become a lot more significant,
because they're simple bonds, aren't they? They're very simple. It's very low, isn't it? Very the minimum bond, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
So can that be changed through electromagnetic frequencies, through pulses of energy?
Not really.
How do they program nanotechnology? How do they actually it's so small. I don't understand it.
It's not really programmed or anything. With the prisms, you're just growing tiny little crystals, and it's not programmed or anything. It's just about sort of finding a way to make really small stuff.
But they're talking about making little machines that can go into our bodies and go to a synapse and change the actions. To me, it sounds like science fiction, but apparently they're saying it's science fact.
They're not that small, but most accelerometers are actually mechanical in a way, but it's just such a small scale.
Little engine, the accelerometer we're talking about?
The accelerometer is the one that can detect like tilt and movement and things. Most phones have them, and a lot of the way they work is that, the way you create them is usually through printing processes where you can use a tiny little, it's basically an inkjet, but you're using a tiny needle to deposit a small amount of material onto a surface.
Okay.
And yeah, that's sort of how you're building these things up. People have made like tiny little pictures. I'm sure you've seen them in the news and things.
What, with quantum dots?
Well, just all sorts of sort of techniques using like dip pen nanolithography to sort of draw little pictures that are a couple of micrometers across, or a couple of
what size?
Yeah,
is that?
A couple of micrometers.
For people, what size is that?
I mean, you're talking some of these ones. I've got a picture here of one in a book, which is the line width is 80 nanometers, which is times 10 to the minus 9 on meters. It's rather small.
And what's one nanometer? What size is that in compared to a human hair?
Hang on. Well, human hair is measured in micrometers.
So a nano is you go micro.
Micro nano.
Yeah. So it's a millionth, isn't it? Is it? So
a human hair is up to about 180 micrometers. And the scale of this image, it's an image of a US 5-cent coin that's been drawn 500 micrometers across. So the whole width of this image is maybe the width of three fairly thick human hairs.
It's minute, isn't it? For the detail to be in that, if it can be enlarged, and it's got the detail,
and there's enough detail when this is like imaged that you can see the full shape of the coin.
All right, guys. So this
is we're not going to drift into Morgellons. We're not going to go there.
Well,
I just thought I'd share some interesting nanochemistry stuff.
I'm interested.
Really
do you know that the House of Lords, there was in 2009, the House of Lords Science and Technology Committee had a big report about the use of nanotechnology in food.
I haven't seen that one.
That's easy. Just put that into computer. Just look up Science and Technology UK House of Lords nanotechnology in food. And it's a long report.
It's interesting stuff. I'll find a link for this book which I'm reading from. I doubt anyone will actually be able to get their hands on a copy of it, but I'm sure some libraries will have it somewhere.
All right, guys. Thank you very much, Max, for coming on the show. You were great. I think you are very dedicated to what you do, and it's been amazing to hear all the research you've been doing. And thank you, Bob. I know you were a little out of your element here, but I think you did really well on the show.
Yay!
And also, thank you so much to the entire cast, I would say, of Dark City Radio. You really helped us getting this show together this week, and we could not have done it without all your help. And you guys, you know who you are. And
can I just add a couple of things just at the end? An aviation medical consultant who checks the blood of pilots for the aerotoxicity syndrome. And he told me that chemtrails, he knows about chemtrails and they've been going on for years. And there are companies like Evergreen Aviation who openly admit to doing weather modification for the US government. So just to end there.
All right. Thank you very much. And we'll be back. It's been a great show. We'll be back soonish. And we hope to have you listening again next time.
And we will have the blog up and running by then, so you guys can actually consult everything we talked about and the documentation linked to it. So thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.